Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. Today, we're so happy to have with us Pierre Padelier. Pierre is the co-founder and co-CEO of NotPla, with the goal of making plastic disappear. NotPla has been using biodegradable seaweed-based materials to change what packaging means. And so the first question we always ask Pierre is, what is one charity or nonprofit that you would like to dedicate this interview to?
Yeah, so I'd love to give a shout to Five Gyres. They do a lot of work on obviously getting rid of plastic in the ocean, but also creating a lot of science so that we can have a better understanding of the actual implications of putting all this material in our oceans.
Got it. Amazing. So yes, we'll start with early on in your background. Your first job was actually quite traditional. You were trained as an engineer. And how did you find your way to your first job? And what do you think you learned from that experience?
Yeah. So actually, when I graduated from high school, there was a first chance of going one direction or another. I was really interested in design. And the problem in France at that time is that design was taught by art schools and you had to go through the arts degree. And on the other end, I was always like really interested in engineering and more of the kind of science direction. And those were seen as two very conflicting directions. And so there was a really hard choice of, do I pursue more this arts like direction or do I go for the engineering school? And following the advice of a very good teacher who said that it's so much easier to bring the design with the arts flavor after having done an engineering degree rather than having to bring engineering degree on top of an arts degree. That felt like a much better kind of like strategic route. So I did that. So I did 5 years of engineering. I actually struggled quite a lot to find motivation because it was definitely a very dry type of studies, but it did give me a rounded engineering training. And I think that served me in terms of credibility, maybe not as much as in terms of like skills learned. But actually, I think I've done so much more engineering when I started to do more design than when I was in engineering school or engineering work. So when I graduated from the engineering school, I thought, what is a good intermediate product that has a strong element of design, but also like some applied engineering? And I thought packaging is a very fast-paced development of products where maybe there will be a little bit more chance for me to have an input and get exposed and learn a bit more about these things. So I thought that it was making quite a lot of sense. I got an internship at L'Oreal and then eventually I got a job there and I worked on launching skincare products in packaging made from plastic for a couple of years in Paris. And that was really like great to learn the industrial scale of things, or all the things that you really just learn on the spot. You can't learn at school, but it was also very disheartening. I think maybe the company has evolved, but like back then it was very siloed. So there was zero chance of being exposed to the part that is not your core job. So the job of the packaging engineer ends here, and the job of like the marketing person ends here, and the job of the product designer starts and ends here. So that was frustrating. And obviously it was also something that was definitely not a passion for me, and seeing the unintended consequences of all this packaging being made, flying on the conditioning line at incredible speed. That was something that really made me lose quickly interest once the technical learnings were gone. And that's when I realized that I wanted to do something a lot more kind of like purposeful. And that's when I applied for this Masters of Innovation Design Engineering in London between the Royal College of Art and Imperial College. And when I got in, I quit my job at L'Oreal and I came to London to study this master's.
That's so interesting. How did you meet your co-founder and how did you come up with this idea?
We were studying together in the same master. So we met masters where everyone has a different background. It's very diverse backgrounds. So he's an architect by background and he's worked in design in different fields, had studied in lots of different places. Super interesting to have the chance of working with him on a few projects along the way. And at some point, we started to work more precisely on this project. The initial idea was to create a man-made fruit, to think if you're going to transport water, we have made this quintessential plastic bottle that's going to last kind of like hundreds and hundreds of years. Archaeologists from the future will find these things in so many different places and be wondering what was going on. And the idea was like, if this was made from nature, what would it be? And the experimentation really started in the kitchen We didn't have access to a lab or anything. So it was very quick and dirty and very hands-on. And after trying a number of different plant extracts from tapioca seeds, different starches, different kind of like types of cellulose, anything we could get our hands on, we stumbled upon the recipe for making fake caviar, which is actually made from seaweed. So these tiny kind of like fish flavored balls that are really much cheaper than real caviar. They were actually developed in the 40s by Unilever to create a more affordable food product. And they use seaweed to encapsulate seaweed extracts to encapsulate this little fish flavored water. And all the patents are now long expired and available on Google. And so it was really great to be able to look at some of those old technologies and try to think with the angle of packaging, how do we get out of the world of food and how do we make a packaging product and proposition of it? We started making the bubbles bigger and bigger. And eventually we made some pretty big ones, like the size of a tomato. And because we were using those extracts, the big surprise is that it's transparent. Even if it comes from seaweed, it's like the flower part of the seaweed, all of the fibrous part that makes it green and smelly is separated. Mm. It was edible. So the cool thing that these bubbles were edible was that this was something you cannot do with any other type of packaging. It's not really something that is even thought of that you could eat your packaging. We made the first few videos, reactions of people, and we put it online. And to our surprise, people were really interested in this and it went viral over the summer without us imagining that was going to be the case. It was a bit a student project that we wanted to wrap up, put it on our portfolio and move on to the next one. But it really grew to a point where people were saying this could really be a viable solution for packaging in lots of different applications. And so seeing the interest, and at that point, our prototypes were very crude. It was still tasting very fishy and salty, and it was definitely not refined. But people's reaction was really a big motivation to take this forward. And we thought maybe we could give this another go and try to develop something that's a little bit more ready to test in the market. And so we applied to a bunch of competitions while we were finishing the second year of our master's. And we won a few of those competitions, which gave us a little bit of budget to spend on R&D. So we initially started working a bit more closely with some of the chemists and chemical engineers at Imperial College that were classmates of someone, or we had different ways of finding our way into the uni to knock on the door of a professor and say, hey, could you do something about resolving this problem with a little bit of cash that we got from this prize, this award? And we thought like we were going to face a lot of challenges, probably stop and then go and apply to get a regular job at a tech company or whatever it is. But to our surprise, we managed to get some nice kind of progress. It wasn't easy for the first couple of years. We were not paying ourselves, really struggling to convince people that this was a serious attempt. But we were also seeing the potential of having in our hands some better prototypes and seeing how we could really start to have a potential kind of replacement for plastic. We started testing in small races and saw that like for marathons, this was a great application. So we were like, this is really something that could replace a lot of plastic. It's worth continuing to give it a shot. And eventually, after a couple of years and not having really managed to get any investment to start executing the plans that we were preparing, we decided to do an equity crowdfunding campaign. So basically, people could invest as little as £10 to buy shares of the company. So that made it very democratic for people to support us rather than only being pitching to angel investors and VC funds who have a much bigger channel, like ticket size. And to our surprise, what like months and months of rejection of those angels turned out to be a 3-day campaign that completely blew up. We raised $1 million in 3 days from 900 people from all around the world. People were really excited. There was lots of social media videos. One of them got 100 million views on Facebook. So we had so many emails and it was just unbelievable, the kind of the difference from one day to another. So that was really like probably the starting point. From that point, we went like full time on the project since 2017 and started to grow the team, get some more support on the different aspects that we were working on: chemistry, engineering, design, business development, production, etc. And that's when we realized that there were a lot of other things that we could be doing with seaweed. And so at that point, we grew to create a catalog of packaging solutions. So the OHO little bubbles, we still use them for marathons and festivals with cocktails or juices, and even with condiments for sauce sachets of ketchup and mayo for like deliveries. We're working on this with Kraft Heinz. But we also realized that there was some other ways that we could leverage seaweed to replace plastic. We started developing takeaway boxes that typically have a thin layer of plastic on the inside. When you receive a salad or curry or whatever it is, the inside of a takeaway box has a thin layer of plastic to protect the cardboard from the grease and the water of the food. That makes the packaging non-biodegradable, non-recyclable. So we are replacing this with seaweed so that the whole thing is completely and naturally biodegradable. And now we're doing it for stadiums and for takeaway restaurants and a lot of on-the-go consumption. We started to develop some films that we can make sachets of. Transparent films that can be heat sealed for dry products.
So that's entirely biodegradable.
Entirely biodegradable. This one is even, it's a, like a noodle bag that you can actually throw the whole thing into the boiling water of your pot and it's going to dissolve. And there is added salt inside. So it adds salt to your noodle. So we can do things with seaweed that you can't do with plastic. And that's like the exciting thing. We can challenge a bit the status quo. And those are examples of the things that we want to bring to large manufacturing scale to commercialize in lots of different places and start having the impact that we want to have.
I see. So what is exactly inside seaweeds and how do you scale the production of this not super common material?
Yeah, a little bit on seaweed. First of all, seaweed is a really amazing resource. It grows for certain species up to a meter per day. So it's incredibly renewable. It doesn't require fresh water or fertilizer. So compared to agriculture, it's zero input. And when it grows, it actually sequesters carbon. The leaves of the seaweed fall to the bottom of the ocean and they get trapped there for thousands of years. So it's actually actively like deep the environment. And importantly for us, it's edible and biodegradable. Seaweed was there before any life on land. Every kind of tree, every kind of organism really came from the sea. So it has had a lot more time to evolve and for the rest of the living world to know how to decompose it very efficiently. So that's why it's extremely easy for end of life where humans might lose control of their packaging and nature has to deal with it. And we've learned a lot about seaweed. There's more than 12,000 species of seaweed. And so all of these have very different components and those components can be used for very different applications. So we actually use a lot of different species for different applications. To give an example of the differences of the genetic diversity that exists in seaweed, there is more difference in certain types of seaweed in their DNA than between a mushroom and a bear. So that's how wide of a spectrum we're talking about. Whereas we just call it seaweed, there's lots of like families, but commonly, we've always put it in just one giant bucket, but there's actually a lot of stuff happening there. So for the past 8 years, we've been working with lots of different seaweed farmers and extractors. We are mostly active in Europe, so we mostly can have seaweed suppliers here, but we've also started to work all around the world. There's obviously a lot of seaweed consumption for food in Southeast Asia. So Southeast Asia is by far the most advanced market for seaweed. They've been running aquaculture of seaweed very efficiently for the past 8 years. So they are absolute masters and the Western world has to play catch up on that. But there's some exciting kind of growth around seaweed farming in Europe and in the US, in Maine. And so there's definitely a renewed interest for seaweed. And we hope that we can create an additional application to the many other benefits that seaweed can have on helping with cosmetics, pharma, medical applications, carbon sequestration, etc.
That's so interesting. That's taking a product that's like less used and being able to scale it and finding the unique amazingness of that product and leveraging that to help the world in some way. It's something that is such a cool concept and to capitalize on what our world has. Although for those who are not material engineers or who don't have the access to know all these things, how do you recommend us look for opportunities that are innovative?
I think being curious, I think one of the things that was really amazing during this master's is that we were like 40 people constantly exposed some quite niche topics and we were feeding on each other's interests. So that was a really exciting time for just being exposed to lots of really hard things to learn about. I think it's not being afraid of going a bit on the dark corners of old technologies or what relatively boring industries might have done in the past that was irrelevant when everything was ruled by petrochemicals. But now we are coming back to nature. So I think there's a lot of things to just do around revisiting some of the stuff that we did 100 years ago and seeing how they are relevant today. And also making jumps between like applications or industries. So what might work as a food product 100 years ago might be a great starting point for a packaging solution today. But it might be that some pharma technology from 50 years ago has an application for fertilizers or food. Or so it's about thinking of how do you take a block of technology and you repurpose it into another one. And then obviously you have to develop that and make it work. But that's one kind of like step to create a novel proposition.
That's so interesting. In a creativity class at Wharton, there was a professor called Ram Schrift, and he taught this idea using almost like an engineering mentality to look at creative solutions and problems. And one of the ideas is taking something that's existing and trying to repens. Using that to solve other issues and what kind of other issues can solve. And almost building a grid of these are the different industries, these are the different types of things, and these are different types of solutions. And if you use the solution for this problem, does it work? It's a very systematic mentality of looking at problems, but it's very interesting as well. Yeah. Do you have any mental models when you think of at work or when you think of problems that you use to help you make decisions?
I think having managed to industrialize now like a couple of products, it's almost the idea and the starting point is important, but it's so much about implementation and getting everything working. So I'd say that it's about not getting too obsessed over finding the right proposition to start with, because actually things will evolve along the way and there will be so much changes, but you have to be on that path. You have to go and trial on big manufacturing lines with a material that they've never tried before and things fail. And then from there, you have some sort of insight that you could do something else. But like those really happen unless you take that first shot. And so I think that, yeah, sometimes that's a bit the pitfall of innovating straight out of university and not confronting yourself immediately to that industrial world, especially for making manufacturing physical products. I think digital is probably like quite different, but there's a big chasm that needs to be bridged. And I think that probably what took us those first couple of years, we could have gone much farther faster if we had confronted ourselves with getting started and being ambitious and just making those opportunities happen faster. Can't redo history. And this is the joy of being a first time founder. I'm sure that things fall into place a little bit more when you're on your second venture or whatever it is, but yeah, I think that one of the big learnings is that it's really down to implementing your idea rather than having a very beautiful idea in the first place.
Down to having an idea rather than having a very beautiful idea in the first place. That's so interesting. You don't need to have the most quality, but you just need to start. Thank you so much, Pierre. I'll open up it now to some of the questions that we have already and also to my team. Do you guys have anything that you want to ask?
I do have a question. In retrospect, being able to look back at this whole evolution of Nopla so far, and you say that this collaborative atmosphere in your graduate school, for instance, was a huge feature of the process and how you guys came about with so many innovations while you were there. Does that translate to this world of startups at all? Are you collaborating with your competition at all? Or is there, because I know a feature of a lot of the innovators in this series is that with these innovative technologies, they're finding it a whole different animal to navigate the world of bureaucracy and regulation in certain countries. And so I'm wondering if you have any advice about working with or in tandem with your competitors in a burgeoning field like this.
For sure. I think we are very realistic that we're not going to solve this on our own. And also, we're not going to solve, like, seaweed isn't going to be a significant packaging material on the market until there is at least 5 or 10 suppliers. Like Unilever is not going to take the risk of shifting a large quantity of their packaging to seaweed if the only supplier is Nopla. So we need to create a healthy competition, which seems a bit counterintuitive because it's great when there's no one really on like your kind of footstep, but equally, we're very clear that we want to be coming on top of that industry. And I think today we are, but that keeps us like pushing and being fast and efficient. I think that the market is so big that there is no issue of not having enough room for competitors to work closely together, help each other with some of those unilateral challenges that you were mentioning around like legal challenges or the way people approach hygiene or safety or some of those topics that usually bring an industry together, even if you are at the end of the day competing in the market. So it's quite interesting to see that there is a number of emerging coalitions and groups where people who are directly competing are working together on helping the whole ecosystem. Obviously, it's not easy because sometimes you've got to also make sure you retain a bit your head start. So it's not full open books with everything. But I think that definitely there's a lot of willingness to help this grow all together, because at the end of the day, the people who are in this are also people who are here for the purpose and for the impact that they can have. And the impact that we can have if the whole system, sustainable packaging grows, is much greater than if one does okay and the rest are not really following. So I think that there is a nice, healthy way of making sure that we achieve impact, whatever it takes. Obviously, it's better if Notpla is like a strong contender. But I think the main kind of like areas of collaboration are also with not only the startup competitors, but everyone on our value chain. And that's where, in a way, collaboration is key, is really like, how do we get the machine manufacturers and the seaweed farmers and the distribution hubs and the brand owners and the waste industry and the legislators to all come together around this? And that's the part where collaboration is key, but it's also very complex. And yesterday I was on a panel trying to establish some guidelines for plastic treaties in the UK. And when you have on the same room Greenpeace and the British Plastic Association, that's necessarily going to clash a little bit. But the fact that you could bring these people together, that's like already half of the solution. So I think that, yeah, like definitely super important to work together.
Another thing that I know that you brought up is that this is your first startup, and you talked about hammering out the whole process of running a startup and making the whole enterprise work while you're still in the R&D process for your products. How do you feel about that? Do you sometimes wish that you had maybe committed more to having the final product before launching Notpla? I know we're still in the middle of the early days of the company and the innovations that you guys have ahead, but and while you're here in the process, you have any notes for that for anyone who might be listening?
I think this is one of the things that I think we're doing quite well at Notpla, is not waiting for every technical parameter to be ready to really push the rest of the proposition against the wall or get an answer on it. Because too often we're like obsessing over a feature that actually the market doesn't really care about. And I think that this is one of the learnings, is that you've got to challenge the brief that you're working on. We're not going to come with a spec sheet of a material that's going to be exactly like plastic. But also, like, very often plastic is completely overspec'd for a particular application. So I think that obviously you've got to reach the point where you have a minimum viable product. But that minimum viable product, sometimes you might put that bar higher than what is really needed. And I think that knowing whether or not there is commercial traction on something before you build it is even better. Like in software, that's like very easy. In hardware, it's a little bit more complex. But this is almost like the commercial R&D side of things. There's the technical R&D, but knowing whether or not this particular proposition communicated this way at this particular kind of place with these kind of like audiences, does that work or not? And I think that's how we treat business development. It's very much like commercial R&D. And yeah, we try as early as possible to get some of that before we build deep, complex like features and solve challenges that require like years to resolve, because otherwise you might just go in direction. It doesn't mean that it's a kind of easy or comfortable position, because when you're getting traction on something that is not ready, you have to manage expectations. But this is the fastest way to make things happen. And like, by working with some very open-minded commercial partners that really understand innovation and want to be on this journey with us, we are opening so many more doors than if we are on our own with a plan, knocking on the door of a big manufacturing partner and then saying like, you are the least priority we have right now. But if you come with this big company that says, hey, I think there is something to do here, then they take you seriously and then you have their attention.
Yeah. I come from a background of working in food service and hospitality a lot. And so when I first heard about this project, the first thing that came to mind for me was like water and cocktails. And I know that's a big thing with the companies I've seen in your videos online, things that you're partnering with like Glenlivet and like big Scotch brands and stuff, which is not a small deal. I know that in food service and hospitality, especially in light of the recent pandemic, that sanitation is a big thing for consumers. And the product from an ecological standpoint makes sense because there's no plastic waste, you can ingest all of it. But how does Noplo work with that aspect of it? Like people who worry about other people handling this thing that they're going to fully digest.
So it's a really interesting topic, which, interestingly enough, is usually more of a theoretical question than a behavior that we notice. Because the moment that like you've got in a room people trying the product, all of the concerns of how this is going to feel and how it is disappear, because the big comparable that we have is fruits. So in a way, fruits have worked for like millions of years, right? We are very used to dealing with them and we are quite good at transporting them in a relatively safe supply chain. And there's all sorts of like things that have been working really well for fruits for us to keep using them even in our industrial age. And so very often when we work with a brand, we try to say, if your product was a fruit, what kind of fruit would it be? And let's make that fruit. And so when you take the example of the fruit, actually you realize that by having like taking measures around how things are handled and where it's produced in a completely food grade facility and the fact that it has a short shelf life, there is actually a lot less risk than some of the other products that we handle all the time. Like we all put Coke to our lips without thinking that this product was made 3 years ago in some factory, maybe like on the other side of the country. It's been sitting in lots of different hubs and so on. But this is fine. The level of risk is low and it's well controlled. So this is a bit the same approach. We are creating a model where the risk is well understood and it's controlled and it's low. And because we work on events rather than retail, we really have this distribution element that makes it very safe, probably safer than a can of a soda. So that's how we handle this.
Cool. Thank you. Going back to the early days back in school, I know that you said that a mentor recommended that because you said your two passions were art and design as well as engineering, and your mentor told you that it would be easier to bring the art and design into an engineering aspect as opposed to the other way around. And then after that, going into L'Oreal, and you said that your whole experience there was all of your projects were siloed. And so you were made to work on this specific thing and not really allowed to flex your wings. Do you look back at any of these experiences and wish that you'd done anything differently?
Yeah, I think back to the advice, I think it was a really great advice. I've seen how, whether it's pure skills or just like credibility, going through that path has really been a very helpful asset to me. But I think that also things are changing a lot. I think that the kinds of curriculums that are available are a lot more kind of like mixed, so that maybe I would have in a similar position be able to find something that is a lot more kind of like halfway house rather than just going like full engineering and then like bringing the design. So I think that, yeah, what was a relatively rare kind of like master's back in 2012 when I went to the Royal College of Art and Imperial College, I think now there's so many unis that are offering this kind of like mix of design engineering that is very relevant because you need those two things to work together. But I think also that you can't plan things too much. Like careers won't be linear and whatever you choose will be an asset at some point or a bit of a drag at another, but you can't really plan it so well beforehand. So I think it's also like releasing some of that pressure that you are like in full control of all these things. There'll be opportunities that arise and they are out of your control. And like you can control the controllables, but like those things, it's not because you've made that choice that you're not going to be able to do something else. And I think that the biggest thing is, I think the level of pressure that like people and probably like myself at some point, but like people put on themselves of choosing one career path over another versus how you see that at the end. It's all quite fluid. And if you have the motivation of going one way, you'll create opportunities for yourself to go there. So I think it's like making it less important in the overall kind of like range of things And if you have a particular interest by studying it on your own or getting exposed to whatever that particular field is doing, and that's all more valuable than necessarily finding the perfect degree that fits all of these things at once together.
Very profound advice. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So amazing to have you on this show.